The following Dharma talk was given by Danica Shoang Ankele Osho
at the Zen Center of New York City.
Shoang Osho is a Dharma holder and priest in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs,
visit us online at zmm.org/ZCNYC.
Thanks for listening.
Good morning. Good morning, Brooklyn. Love being down here with all of you. So good. Okay. Joshin said, I live up at the monastery. My name is Shoan. I use she, her pronouns. And Hojin Sensei, who is the abbot of the temple, is away on vacation this week. So it's been my pleasure to be here in her absence. Okay. So, I don't know about you, but I have been working with feeling heavy-hearted lately, and this is the perfect condition in which to really commit ourselves to practice. And yesterday we did a Zazen Kai, a full day sit, and it's so good to see so many of you back today. And I talked a little bit about spiritual power at this time where we're seeing worldly political power on such vivid display, advancing, opposing, being used, being misused. I thought it's a good time to look at spiritual power. And I talked about how this spiritual power is, we might think of it as having these different facets or different components or different energies. Maybe that's a better way to say it. An energy of great stability, unshakable presence, and the power of fluidity, of being able to move with the unceasing flow of reality. I was thinking about like a sort of New York City analogy, and here's what I came up with. It's imperfect, but I hope you'll appreciate the effort. Like, you know how when you're on the subway, if you're like a seasoned New Yorker, I grew up in the city, you like learn how to be on the subway and stay grounded, right, while it's moving. And I remember at some point sort of kind of cultivating a practice of not holding on to anything. And so, you know, you're like careening through. And then what happens at that moment where the subway stops? Right? You have to be able to move with it. And if you can, no problem. And you can always tell new arrivals to the city, right? Because when the subway stops, they're like totally unprepared. So how do we do this in life? How do we do this in the deep level when the sort of the ride is intense, it's fast, the stations are flying by, we're on the express, and we don't even know how we got there. And we have to live well. So just kind of like to extend that metaphor a little bit, just like how, you know, it takes a few trips. It takes a few trips to kind of know how to navigate that that experience. In the same way, we have to know how to. We have to understand. We have to understand more and more deeply this experience, and that's what practice is about. in a way, you could say that one of the core teachings of Buddha Dharma and of Zen as a school of Buddhism is this knowing what's happening and how it works, being a study of duality and non-duality. So those are big words, and we're going to go into them in this talk. And to tell you the truth, this morning when I saw I think a lot of new people here, maybe some first timers. And I was thinking of my talk and I was like, ooh, did I sort of bite off too much? And then we started with the Heart Sutra and I was like, oh no, we're fine. Because right when you come in the door, we're already chanting, form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. So you've been introduced to the radical nature. Yeah. So we talk about, there are two truths. And we call these truths the relative and the absolute. We chanted this morning too. The identity of relative and absolute. You see where this is going, right? Spoiler alert! So the relative truth is it's the world that we live in. It's the world of phenomena. It's the world of a multiplicity of beings and forms and all the things. It's me and you, and you're having your experience, and I'm having my experience, and I have my life story, and you have yours. And we're each doing our best to find our way in this life. And then there's the absolute. And the absolute is it's like the source. We speak about it as the source or the ground of being. We speak about it as like the fundamental essence that we all share. We speak about it as the ocean and the waves, so the ocean being the absolute and the waves being the relative. And often when people are drawn to a practice like Zen, you kind of have a feeling that there's the absolute, right? You're like, finding your way in the relative world, and you're like, I feel like there's more. There's something else. I remember there was a particular time when I was in high school, and I just remember I would like lie on my bed in my room and think, I want to go home. And I would think, like, that doesn't make sense. I'm home. But that's the words that came to me. So in our journey, in our path, in our practice, we are sort of making contact with and clarifying that source, that home, that absolute is us. So that's non-duality. And, you know, sometimes we speak in ways that feel or sound like, okay, there's going to be this experience where I like know that really clearly, and like that's what I'm working towards, and like when that happens, great, and then I'll be able to like get on with the rest of my life. And although there are, you know, experiences and moments that we may have where we feel like, oh, there's a certain kind of contact, that clarifying just takes place across a whole lifetime of practice. And for sure, earlier in my practicing life, if and when I heard that teaching, I would feel a little bit like, God, what a bummer, like forever. And now I feel like, wow, Amazing. You know, when we're given the practice of Zazen, as some of you were this morning, and it's such a grounded practice, and it's like, you know, it just takes half an hour to impart that instruction, we can feel like, what does that have to do with the deep Dharma? And I guess you're just going to have to stick around to find out. That's totally what I thought. And boy, it works because of that deep non-dual truth, right? Because your essence is Buddha mind, because you're not trying to create something or make something, you're just discovering and clarifying what's completely full-blown, present already. Because of that, all we need is a method to settle the agitated state of our being. That's the only thing that's separating us. And it turns out that that agitation can settle deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until we can see for ourselves what my first teacher, Daito Roshi, used to say: this body and mind is the body and mind of the universe. So we talk about what obscures the full-blown experience of our perfect nature. In some Buddhist texts, it's talked about as adventitious defilements. And what this means is not, I feel like, what it sounds like. It means that these are sort of stains, if you will, on the mind. It's like very clunky ways of speaking about it, but we'll work through that, that are not inherent. So the adventitious means they occur like accidentally. They're not inherent. They're not intrinsic. They can be worked with. They can be cleared away. And in Mahayana Buddhism and in Zen for sure, what we're actually practicing to see is that those stains are also not truly existent. We don't actually have to clear anything away. We just need to see through. We just need to see through. So what are these mental stains? Well, we talk about greed and anger and ignorance, right? Afflictive states of mind and all of their accompanying sort of qualities and manifestations. Anything where we feel tight, where we feel bound, where we feel fixated, where anger arises, where greed or jealousy or arrogance arise, these are all what we would call adventitious defilements. These are all obscuring our original pure nature. And then if you take it like all the way through, at the very bottom, any conceptual thought can be understood as an adventitious defilement. So when we're settling the mind and coming back to the breath again and again and again, we are letting go of conceptual mind and training and being present, and in that way, opening the door to this known experience of our true nature. So, these adventitious defilements, we really got to be on to them because they're just popping up all the time. And that's why this is such a good time to be a practitioner. We were talking, the residents at breakfast this morning, just about views and opinions, and like how someone was sharing how like even like looking at the news and seeing their self-righteous indignation rise up, they had to see like, oh, like there's a way in which that's I'm kind of into feeling upset. I'm kind of generating an afflictive state of mind. That self-righteous quality that I feel about my views and my opinions and so on and so forth, we have to start to recognize, okay, that's actually the poison. And we can hear that and think, well, wait a second, without my views, without my sense of self-righteousness, like how am I going to know how to respond to the world? I don't want to just like be passive or, you know, let all hell break loose and I'm just like sitting there. So this is the tension. This is the tension. It's a really live tension. We have to, or we can, if we want, cultivate our wisdom mind. And in this wisdom mind, there is great compassion. The teaching in Buddhism is that wisdom and compassion are also non-dual. They come along indivisible. And, you know, in kind of in Western philosophy, we can talk a lot. We, you know, typically use the word understand. And I was listening to a teaching by the Buddhist scholar and venerable practitioner Robert Thurman not long ago, and he was saying that he thought the word understanding was kind of authoritarian. And he said, because it's etymologically speaking, you have to stand under what other people have said. Right? That's understanding. Oh, okay, I understand Heidegger or Kant or whatever. And he was saying for him, one of the draws of the Dharma was that it felt like it didn't have that quality. It was about realizing. It was about direct experience. So, moving on, Pema Chodron writes in her book, Things Fall Apart. I think that's the title. Is that the title of Pema Chodron? Okay. When Things Fall Apart. I'm editorializing, sorry. Things falling apart is a kind of testing. Things falling apart is a kind of testing and also a kind of healing. We think that the point is to pass the test or to overcome the problem. But the truth is that things don't really get solved. They come together and they fall apart. They come together again and they fall apart again. It's just like that. The healing comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen. Room for grief, for relief, for misery, for joy. We can go over that teaching and miss just how deep it is. And that's why it's not about understanding. It's about experiencing and realizing. Because as that teaching more and more becomes your own life, more and more you feel freer, more resilient, more able to respond to the cries of the world, less stuck, less reactive. She says, the healing comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen. Yeah. Guess what? There's a lot of space. There's a lot of space. We constrict space. We bind space. Our very nature, the Dharma teaches, is space. We're the ocean. That's a vast space. It's interesting, right? Even like scientifically now we know that like 99.99% of matter is empty space. Isn't that mind-blowing? So when we're suffering, a really great practice is to look and see, where am I constricting? Where am I getting stuck? Where am I getting tight? And we can feel, right, like we were talking about at breakfast, we can feel like, yeah, I'm getting tight and I want to get tight, damn it. Fine. It's your suffering. If you want it. And that's the suffering works. We don't contain it. We don't contain anything. So when we're suffering, we spread it around. And that's the mess that we see. So how do we then actually orient to the spacious quality of life? As a practitioner, right? We can hear that teaching and say like, okay, that sounds good, but like, what do I actually do? So I want to return to Pema Chodron. She says, to stay with that shakiness, to stay with a broken heart, with a rumbling stomach, with the feeling of hopelessness and wanting to get revenge. To stay with that feeling is the path of true awakening. What? Sticking with that uncertainty, getting the knack of relaxing in the midst of chaos, learning not to panic. This is the spiritual path. Getting the knack of catching ourselves, of gently and compassionately catching ourselves, is the path of the warrior. We catch ourselves one zillion times as once again, whether we like it or not, we harden into resentment, into bitterness, into righteous indignation. If we harden in any way, even in a sense of relief, a sense of inspiration. So this is the fluidity of spiritual power. Just space. How do we practice being that space? She goes on to say that we're not striving to make pain go away or to become a better person. We're giving up control altogether and letting concepts and ideas fall apart. This starts with realizing that whatever occurs is neither the beginning nor the end. It is just the same kind of normal human experience that's been happening to everyday people from the beginning of time. Thoughts, emotions, moods, and memories come and they go. The basic nowness is always here. In the midst of all the heavy dialogue with ourselves, open space is always there. Again, the danger is that we hear a teaching on spaciousness, on openness, and we think, or emptiness, right, using that word, and we think like that sounds so kind of cold or sterile or like uncaring. Okay, that's our understanding mind. So we have to experience, we have to go inside and see for ourselves, what's the quality? If we practice in that way, what's the quality of our experience? That's where we can find that soft, open, loving, connected heart. There's no other place you're going to find it. It can't blossom when things are tight and bound. Right? I mean, don't you know, like, when your love is feeling full and flowing, it's because, like, you're open, there's room, there's space. So I wanted to go into a great teaching that is, I've been thinking about it, and I thought, oh, I'm going to bring it up in my talk. And then I was looking at it, and I thought, oh, no, it's too hard. It's too hard. But I think we can do it. I think I can do it. We'll just take a small piece, okay? And may it be for our collective benefit. So this is a moment that is happening in the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is a Mahayana sutra. And it's distinct. A couple of things that might be helpful to know about this sutra. It was written in Sanskrit originally, in the first to second centuries. Several hundred years after the Buddha's life. And it's beloved by the Zen school because of its teaching on direct insight, direct experience over conceptual knowledge. It's basically a teaching about non-duality. And one of the things that's interesting about it is that why I think it's a nice one to bring in here is that Vimalakirti, who's the deeply realized being at the heart of the sutra, is a lay person living in the world, and it's his teachings that are forming the ground. And so that was a radical shift in how teachings were presented. So you can kind of feel like, oh, this is going to ask us to let go of our conceptual mind in some very direct sort of stirring ways, right? The monastic tradition would have been really held up. You would have had the Buddha or the Buddha's disciples as the ones who are really speaking the deep truth. And here's this lay person who's giving voice to it. And the part that we're going to read has another amazing sort of like topsy-turvy radical moment. Well, it's like radical moment on top of radical moment. It's a section where a goddess appears. And she gives this really deep teaching to a monk. Okay, let's see. What else do you need to know for setup? I think that's enough. So there's this. So the chapter that I wanted to just take a section of is chapter 7. It's called The Goddess. And I'm not going to lie. I love it because of that alone. Okay? We don't have enough goddesses in Zen, so when you find one, you really want to, like, bring it out, okay? So so in this chapter, just a little bit of setup. Basically, the chapter is a teaching that starts with a teaching between Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom, and Vimalakirti, the great sage, the lay person, the realized lay person. And the first part of the teaching is about how all living beings are insubstantial. So Manjushri asks Vimalakirti, how should a bodhisattva regard all living beings? And Vimalakirti goes through this long list of metaphors that are each one pointing to how insubstantial a living being is. I'll just give you a couple. He says, Manjushri, a bodhisattva should regard all living beings as a wise person regards the reflection of the moon in water, or as a magician regards a person created by magic. He should regard them as a being like a face in a mirror, like a mass of clouds in the sky, like the previous moment of a ball of foam. It's like super insubstantial. And it goes on like that, okay? Metaphor after metaphor after metaphor. So we're in this like totally open, groundless, it's just space, 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 okay? We're like in the wave. It's like going in the wave and like recognizing that it's just ocean. It's just ocean. The waves are coming and going, and it's just ocean. So that's how it begins. And then the dialogue develops. And Vimalakirti says, no, Manjushri says, noble sir, if a bodhisattva considers all living beings in such a way, then how do they generate the great love toward them? Great question, right? You're like, okay, well, if everybody's just like a foam, like why? How am I supposed to be a bodhisattva and care about saving them and taking care of them? And they're just a ball of foam. And Vimalakirti says, yeah, okay. The bodhisattva has to generate this love inside of them that is firm. Thereby, they generate the love that is firm. Its high resolve is unbreakable, like a diamond. The love that is pure, purified in its intrinsic nature. And he goes on, the love that is the great compassion, da-da-da-da-da, on and on, in all of these other metaphors for how strong this love is. So on the one hand, we have this insubstantiality of all these beings, and at the same time, like such a love for them. Such a love. It's so real, right? Because we look and we can start to see, like, okay, as I work with my own mind, I can start to see I'm not so solid. I'm not so solid. And then we can look out and be like, wow, nobody's so solid. And then we can see, like, oh my God, but there's so much suffering. There's so much pain. I just, makes me love everyone even more. That's the teaching, okay? So there we are. So then Manjushri and Vimalakirti sort of have this back and forth encounter where Manjushri is really trying to get to the bottom of things. And there's this whole series of questions that basically resolve in Vimalakirti saying, there is no bottom. There's no bottom. Oh, I only have a few minutes and there's so much to say, but it's okay. It's okay. It's okay. We have to just power through and get to the part that I meant to get to. Okay, so there's no bottom. You with me? Okay. There's no bottom. And so Vimalakirti says, Manjushri. So Manjushri says, well, what is the root of this baselessness? And Vimalakirti says, Manjushri. When something is baseless, how can it have any root? Therefore, all things stand on the root which is baseless. Thereupon, a certain goddess who lived in that house, having heard the teaching of the Dharma of the great heroic bodhisattvas, and being delighted, pleased, and overjoyed, manifested herself in a material body and showered the great spiritual heroes, the bodhisattvas, and the great disciples with heavenly flowers. So she's so delighted by this teaching of baselessness that she's just like can't contain herself. She manifests in physical form and showers everyone with flowers. It's such a good religion, right? So there's a whole thing about the flowers, and we're just skipping it, all right? So now, here we go. She delivers this intense teaching on non-duality. She just like is laying it out. Shariputra, who's one of the Buddha's primary disciples, is asking some questions, and she's just letting it rip. And then Shariputra goes, Goddess, what prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state? So he's hooked here. Here's what you have to know. In sort of traditional classic Buddhist literature and teachings, people say, not original to the Buddha. It directly contradicts the Buddha's direct teachings, but it got sort of added on and perverted afterwards, that you had to be born in a male body to be a realized being. So radical, right? So Shariputra's taking in the goddess. He's like, okay, she is totally realized. What's she doing in a female body then? And that's how he asks his question. Goddess, what prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state? And the goddess says, although I have sought my female state for these 12 years, I have not yet found it. Reverend Shariputra, if a magician were to incarnate a woman by magic, would you ask her, what prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state? Shariputra says, no. Such a woman would not really exist. So what would there be to transform? The goddess says, just so, Reverend Shariputra, all things do not really exist. Now, would you think, what prevents one whose nature is that of a magical incarnation? That's our nature, from transforming herself out of her female state. She asks the question, knowing that you are nothing more than a previous moment of a ball of foam, even while your heart is filled with this expansive love, is this question of transforming out of your female state? Would you ask it? She says. And as she says that, thereupon, the goddess employed her magical power to cause the elder Shariputra to appear in her form and to cause herself to appear in his form. Then the goddess, now transformed into Shariputra, said to Shariputra, transformed into the goddess, Reverend Shariputra, what prevents you from transforming yourself out of your female state? And Shariputra, transformed into the goddess, replied, I no longer appear in the form of a male. My body has changed into the body of a woman. I do not know what to transform. The goddess continued, if the elder could again change out of the female state, then all women could also change out of their female states. All women appear in the form of women in just the same way as the elder appears in the form of a woman. While they are not women in reality, they appear in the form of women. With this mind, with this in mind, the Buddha said, in all things, there is neither male or female. Then the goddess released her magical power, and each returned to their ordinary form. She said to him, Reverend Shariputra, what have you done with your female form? She's trying to show Shariputra the deep Dharma truth. Not so he understands it, but so he realizes it. If we think about ourselves and wherever we might fixate on our identity, and whoever we might put as outside, other, in a real way, right, that works up our passions, we are getting stuck in the same way. Imagine you opened your eyes and you were in that body of that other. And you saw them in your body. What would the realization of that moment do to how you see the world? To how you see living beings. just as you might look down and say, this isn't me. In the same way, even now, this is true. What happens as we begin, little by little, to suspect this, to hear the teaching, to glimpse, to touch, to deepen into the how true it is? What happens to how we regard living beings? There becomes no place to hold on to. There is nothing to fixate on. And the teaching is very clear. What's left then is love. Just love. Imagine if the goddess came and worked her magic and you saw yourself transformed, 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 body after body after body after body. There are Dharma teachings that say this is what's happening, right? The teaching of rebirth. It's just causes and conditions that put us here in this body now. The previous moment of a ball of foam. Pema Chodron says, we don't set out to save the world. We set out to wonder how other people are doing and to reflect on how our actions affect other people's hearts. So simple, so deep. And so we can be guided in this way at this time. The three pure precepts to cease from harm, to practice good, to actualize good for others. And from this place, then, it's a moral question. It's not anything goes. It's a moral question. It's acting with clear understanding of what every being truly is. Every being possessing this Buddha nature, dignity, worthiness, beauty. When we vilify, cast out, scapegoat, suffering is sure to follow. All beings, then, should be treated fairly. That we relate to all beings from a place of love, from a recognition of our connection, how interrelated we are. That the suffering of beings should be helped. That people should be protected, taken care of, given a chance to thrive. That the earth is also our body and should also be treated with love and with reverence. All beings connected in this boundless, singular ocean. So at such a time, to root in the depth, to sink below the roiling surface, to choose your actions and how you live and how you manifest from as clear a ground as you can muster. It's an excellent time to be a practitioner.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.